Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Simon Rose. Welcome to episode 103, I believe, of The World Shapers. Hard to believe, but there you go. And it's going to be a very good episode with Simon Rose as my guest. Before we get to that, just a few things to touch on. I want to talk about publishing. I have a publishing company called Shadow Paw Press, which I formed in 2018, and it's slowly expanding. Before I talk about that, though, I do want to remind you that one of the things Shadow Paw Press has published is two anthologies that feature authors who were guests on the World Shapers podcast. Shapers of Worlds, the original anthology, was successfully kickstarted in 2020, and it has new fiction from Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, Ellie Modisett Jr., DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and me, and reprints from John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie E. Schreneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thoreya Dyer. Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which is much more recent, came out in November of last year, or October, and was kickstarted back in March of last year. It features new fiction from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kessler, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Saul, and that Edward Willett guy again. And there are reprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S. M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. So both of those are available now widely wherever you'd like to buy books. You can use the easy URL books2read2.com/shapersofworlds for the first one. And books2read, again, numeral2.com/shapersofworlds2 for the second one. And that will take you to where you can buy it in both print and ebook. You can also get it directly from shadowpawpress.com in both print and ebook as well. So I hope you'll check that out. The next thing coming up from Shadow Paw Press will be a Kickstarter to support the publishing of Shapers of Worlds Volume 3. So Volume 1 was first year guests, Volume 2 was second year guests, and Volume 3 will be third year guests of this podcast. Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 will feature another great selection of authors, third-year guests, as I said, of the podcast. And there'll be new fiction from Griffin Barber, Gerald Brandt, Miles Cameron, Sebastian de Castell, Christy Cherish, David Ebenbach, Mark Everglade, Frank J. Fleming, Violet Milan, Anna Musicat, James Morrow, Jesse Owen, Robert Pinner, Kat Rambo, K.M. Rice, and me. There'll be poetry from Jane Yolen and reprints from Cory Doctorow, Kay Eason, Walter John Williams, and F. Paul Wilson. So that's going to be very exciting. I'm currently looking to launch that, I believe it's March 4th, the first Tuesday in March. And that's what I'm aiming for anyway. If it gets delayed, it might be a week after that, but that's the current goal. So keep an eye out for that, and I will, of course, let you know here all about that. The other thing I wanted to say about Shadow Paw Press, as I said, it is expanding. I have contracted to publish two brand new books this year, in addition to Shapers of Worlds Volume 3, a young adult novel by Matthew Hughes called The Emir's Falcon, and a novel by a new Saskatchewan writer, Gail M. Smith, called Thickwood, which combines horseback riding, romance, and professional women's baseball. So that's going to be a fun one to bring out. And then under the imprint Shadow Paw Press Reprise, I am beginning to contract authors to republish work that was previously published by traditional publishers, orphaned for whatever reason, the rights have reverted, and the author is looking for a new place to have those books appear. I've got a couple of contracts out now I'm waiting to hear back from. So that is open to you if you're an author and you have a rights reverted, previously published novel, traditionally published, that has, for whatever reason, the rights have come back to you. You perhaps don't want to climb the self-publishing learning curve. This is a publishing deal. It's not fee for service, so it's a royalty-based arrangement, author-friendly royalty contract. No cost to the author if I decide to take it on. So again, I'm not taking on everything. It has to fit into what I think Shadowpaw Press should be. But if you have a book like that and you're interested, you can get hold of me at publisher@shadowpawpress.com. Okay, that's probably enough jabber off the top. Let's get on to this episode's guest, Simon Rose. Simon Rose graduated from university with a degree in history and is also a graduate of the Institute of Children's Literature of West Reading, Connecticut, which, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Simon's first novel for middle grade readers, The Alchemist Portrait, was published in 2003, followed by The Sorcerer's Letterbox in 2004, The Clone Conspiracy in 2005, The Emerald Curse in 2006, The Heretic's Tomb in 2007, The Doomsday Mask in 2009, The Time Camera in 2011, The Sphere of Septimus in 2014, Future Imperfect in 2016, The Fleischback Series, The Shadow Zone Series, and The Stone of the Seer Series. That's hard to say. The Stone of the Seer Series. He's also the author of The Children's Writer's Guide, The Working Writer's Guide, The Time Traveler's Guide, The Social Media Writer's Guide. He's a contributing author to The Complete Guide to Writing Science Fiction, Volume 1, and he's written many nonfiction books. Fairly prolific. Simon offers a number of services for writers as well, including editing and manuscript evaluation, coaching, mentoring, writing workshops, as well as copywriting services for the business community. He's an instructor for adults with the University of Calgary and offers online workshops for both children and adults, and he also offers a wide variety of presentations, workshops, and author-in-residence programs for schools and libraries and virtual author visits. He's a regular presenter at conferences and festivals, which is where we've met over the years, and has served as a juror for the Governor General's Literary Awards for Children's Literature, the Saskatchewan Book Awards, I've won one of those, the Parsec Awards, and the Sunburst Awards for Canadian Literature of the Fantastic. He's the founder of Children's Authors and Illustrators on Facebook, managed the Calgary Children's Book Fair and Conference, served as the writer-in-residence with the Canadian Authors Association, is a member of the Calgary Association of Freelance Editors, and served as the Assistant Regional Advisor for Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators of Western Canada. Oh, welcome to the World Shapers, Simon.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just beginning to wonder with all that how I've ever found time to write anything.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that myself.
Yes.
There's actually a lot of parallels between your writing career and mine. I've done some of those same things, all the books, but I've also written a lot of nonfiction children's books and copywriting for the business community and taught classes, and it all sounds very familiar. And the reason I mentioned the Institute of Children's Literature was there that I hadn't thought about it for a while, but I think I did that program way back in the mists of time. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, it is quite a while ago. I think I did that. I think that was before the first book was even started to be written, I think. I was doing that, yes. It was, probably back to that, more than 20 years ago, I think that. Yeah.
Well, I think I might have been doing it in the 80s. I think that's why it's kind of fading.
It's been around a while. I'm not sure if it's still around.
Yeah, have a look.
Might be, but it was a while ago. But it was certainly very useful because at the time I knew probably I had, like most people, I suppose, I had lots of ideas and thought I could write them down and become an author, but had no real clue how it all worked. So that was very helpful.
Well, I mentioned the mists of time, so let's take you back there.
Oh.
And tell me about your background, where you grew up, and how you got interested in writing. Most of us started as readers, I presume you did, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, readers, and yes, and a lot of the things that I'd been, watching on TV and movies and things like that. I grew up with things like Star Trek and things like that, I suppose, and science fiction, and I was always very interested in time travel stories. And also, history was something I got a degree in the end at university and everything, so I was always interested in that, and the things seemed to sort of combine and things, I suppose, but... When I first had kids, I was reading children's books, as we all do, I suppose, for the first time in many years. You know, obviously picture books and things like that, I suppose. And with some of them, I thought, well, some of them were quite good, and some of them were, weren't as good. And I remember thinking to myself, well, surely I could come up with a story as good as this, perhaps, just for, but not being an illustrator, picture books weren't something I was seriously sort of considering and things. But then I found a little ad somewhere for the Institute of Children's Literature and went on from there. I started looking into taking a course just to see where it would go. And and the institute at the time had a a newsletter. I presume it was something that came in the mail once a month if you were enrolled in the course. And I remember seeing this this little story on the front cover way back in late 90s, I suppose, and it said something about controversy continues to surround Harry Potter. And I thought, ooh, who's this guy? He sounds like an interesting, controversial kids author. I didn't know. My kids were very young at the time. It was picture book time for them. And so reading this thing, I quickly realized that this was actually a character and it was a series of books and everything. And then, again, thought nothing much of it. But then I was at a bookstore and I saw the first one. I thought, oh, that's that book that I read about. And so I read the first Harry Potter book. And that was a sort of inspirational in a sense, because I'd had all these wonderful ideas, I suppose, about writing stories. But I had no idea where I could go with them. And I wasn't particularly interested in writing stories about magic and wizards and folklore and all that sort of stuff at all. But that the first Harry Potter books, the first two or three anyway, that told me really what age group I was interested in writing for, because those were sort of for younger than the later ones, I suppose. These were for kids, probably early teens, I suppose, 12 years old or something like that. That was the sort of, the level of danger for the reader, I suppose, the scariness of the stories. I thought that's the sort of age range I'm interested in writing for. And of course, then as I mentioned earlier, the things that interested me were science fiction and time travel and space, and I read an awful lot of comic books growing up as well, so superhero stuff as well, and it all sort of combined. And that's where, I guess, the long story short, perhaps that's where it all began. Those first couple of novels, at least, were probably some of the first ideas I had. And I was fortunate enough that a publisher became interested in them, and the story began, I guess.
Well, taking you even further back, you grew up in England. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody who listens to your voice. Did you ever do any writing when you were really young, growing up? Did you, play around with writing or stories or storytelling?
I did the same as probably everybody else did. It was always a case, really, of being, I suppose, I might have done a few bits and pieces. Nothing that I can recall now, I don't think. It wasn't something I'd ever considered doing. Certainly not as a career or anything like that. I don't think I've got any ideas or story ideas, that are written down that go way back to when I was, 6 or 7 years old or anything like that. No, it wasn't something I was playing around with back then. It was really just all these different things that I was, either reading in comics and in books or watching on TV and in movies and things like that, I suppose, is what I remember mostly from my childhood, I suppose. But certainly where I grew up in the UK and everything certainly has influenced all the different sort of topics, I suppose, that I've been writing about. The latest series is historical fiction / fantasy, I suppose, as well. Most of the time it's about English sort of history and things like that. I mean, although I have a history degree, there are certain time periods, as you'd expect, that are, I suppose, favourites of mine or ones that I'm interested in writing stories about. And sometimes they're not particularly the ones that other people have been, constantly writing about, that may be a bit overdone, I guess. So certainly that my time in the UK where I grew up and the sort of things I was reading about and what stuff that was on TV, historical stuff, certainly has been an influence on what I'm writing about in this latest series, and the one I'm also working on next is also going to be have history or historical basis to it too.
Well, what drew you to history? I mean, you went on and got a degree in it, so clearly you must have been fascinated by the subject.
Well, I think I was. I was fascinated by. I again, this is it's people have asked me this sort of thing before, and I'm not sure particularly, I suppose, but I know that when, well, at least when I was a kid growing up, your parents will, you know, take you to entertain you, I suppose, on day trips and weekends away and things like that. And in the UK, of course, there's an awful lot of opportunities to visit stately homes and castles and things like that. There seem to be castles and old buildings just about everywhere. And so you're sort of brought up with that. It's all part of it. And I know I went to quite a few holidays in Wales and things when I was a kid. So there'd always seem to be a castle nearby. There were castles near where I was brought up. Every single town and even small village seems to have a church that's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years old. So you've got all that growing up and everything. And I remember even at sort of in the later stages of elementary school, I was learning about things like the Vikings, you know, and Alfred the Great and all these sort of things. And it was just fascinating to me that this had all, I suppose, happened in the past and things. And then, of course, when you got onto the next level of school, you were learning about, you know, the Henry VIII and his six wives and the English Civil War and goodness knows what else. And it was just, I don't know, it was just fascinating to me. And it became my favorite topic, I suppose, at school. And then I was, the intention was that I would go and get a degree in this and possibly go into the teaching profession and teach this myself. That didn't work out at the time just because circumstances and things at the time, and I went on to do different things. But that was the plan, I guess. But since then, since I've been writing professionally, I suppose I've done quite a bit of that. History has obviously gone into many of the books that I've written, and I've taught classes and done presentations at festivals and conferences and things as well on writing historical fiction. So in the end, I have ended up using that interest and the qualification, I suppose, in the end.
I didn't specifically say it in the introduction, but you live in Calgary now. What brought you over from the UK in 1990, I think it was?
1990, yes. Well, it was at the time, my spouse at the time and I had connections. There was family connections in Calgary, and we had visited Calgary and everything, and on vacation and everything, and it then became looking into the possibility perhaps of moving and living in Calgary. This doesn't always happen, I don't think, to people if they're just simply visiting. If they have friends who have always lived in another place, it's not quite the same as if you're visiting people who used to live in the place where you are. I mean, so these were family members who had lived in both countries, so they could see the difference between the two, I guess. That made a difference. We'd also visited some relatives who were in the Toronto area as well, so we'd been to that part of Canada. But in the end, if you're going to be moving countries, I suppose, and giving it a try and seeing if it's going to work for you, you've got to go somewhere where there's going to be got to be work. And at the time, I certainly wasn't a professional writer at the time. I had to find jobs doing something. And at the time, Calgary was a, you know, obviously quite a big city, and there were opportunities for getting settled in and everything else. And I think at the time, just like maybe for a lot of people, even though it's a major commitment, I think there's always the option of returning to the UK if things don't work out. But in the end, you put down roots, I suppose, and you start families and you buy houses and settle in and have pets and goodness knows what else and forge careers, and before you know it, quite a few years have gone by.
Those roots go down pretty quick.
Yes, exactly.
And I think we probably met, the times we've met, it has usually been in Calgary at a writing conference of one sort or another, either Conversion back in those days or more recently, When Words Collide.
And there was also the when we had the World Fantasy Convention here, actually,
right?
Yeah, and that would have been, I don't know, 2005 or six or something like that. I do remember that one, and certainly, yeah, When Words Collide, and there was Conversion before that, and everything. So yes, I've been fortunate to be invited to quite a few conferences and things over the years as well in different parts of the. Of the country, sometimes science fiction and fantasy related, sometimes children's and young adult writing related. That, of course, like so many other things, has sort of it's not been happening in recent years, has it? Because of the situation we've been in.
Yeah, something's been different recently. I can't quite remember what it is.
But I know that I did do the. I had visited the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo as a visitor here, which was a big event, and they'd be getting big celebrities would come here to this to the event and everything, and I'd wondered about having exhibit space there and everything, and I started, I think it was about 2013, 2014, something like that, I started to exhibit at that event. And I'm hoping to do it again this year. It's supposed to be going ahead. We're going to have to wait and see. But for the last couple of years, I have not been able to do that. But that's a great event for somebody who's writing the sort of material and things that I am doing. And I get a lot of leads from it. And usually sell quite a few books and things as well. So other conferences have not been happening. But I'm certainly open to going to them, hopefully. As we were saying before we started here, there'll be When Words Collide will be happening in 2022, but as an online event. But it's been an online event before, and it does work in that format. So, I think there's you're one of the guests of honor, aren't you, this year?
Yeah, it's like three major New York Times bestsellers and me. So it's
good Lord.
I feel a bit like one of these things is not quite like the others, but anyway.
Ah, who knows? It might change your life.
Yeah. I was going to say on the Calgary Expos, I've actually thought about coming to Calgary to exhibit there. I've done it locally in Sask Expo, which is supposed to happen this year as well. Supposed to. Of course, there's a much greater impact on expenses if I try to go to Calgary for 3 or 4 days and set up, but
I know that it was I had shared space with people over the years, and I know that the last time I did it's usually in the spring in April, but the last they also did a Christmas one that took place in early December. I think that was the last one I did. It was in 2019, and then the 2020 one was cancelled, or maybe shelved, or maybe postponed might be the right word. I know that, but it's with a lot of those events, it's not just a case of how many books you sell. For me, anyway, it never has been. If I meet an awful lot of people, I get rid of an awful lot of business cards to people because I do, as well as writing books. Which obviously, writing books takes quite a while, and it's not something you don't put out a new book every week or every month or anything like that. It's a long process. But I do work with other people as well, mentoring, editing, coaching, and things like that. So I, at one point when I was doing a lot of book signings at local bookstores, I would often meet parents and teachers and things, which would help me with visiting schools and things. But as that sort of dried up a little bit, I started to meet more people who were just getting started, as you and I once were years ago, and people were especially, in fact, this has happened more in recent years, I suppose. There's a lot more scope now for people to self-publish quality books with Amazon and everything else. And so a lot more people seem to be taking the plunge these days into writing a book and things, and they would like someone like you and I, who's experienced in all this, to help them out and take a look at their material and a bit of editing and goodness knows what else. And so I found that the expo was good for that as well. And so it's a worthwhile event. And so that's one of the reasons why this year it's like, well, let's give it a try. And what the attendance will be like is completely unknown. And of course it may, hopefully we'll not have anything happen with our pandemic situation that will cause it to be postponed again. But at the moment it seems like it's a good option and worthwhile doing.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way about them. It's as much about being visible and meeting people and getting your name out there and making connections as it is the number of books that you sell. Although I usually
you can't just judge it on the books. No, I mean, so I've done actually quite well as well at the expo. I mean, with some events, I have made the decision, to think, well, I didn't sell that many books, even though I met a lot of people. But with the expo, it's sort of a mixture of both. I do make quite a lot of connections with other writers and just and people who would like my help, and I've even met people who wanted me to write non-fiction books for children, which I've done an awful lot of those over the years. I did meet a publisher at I think it was at an event like that. I met them at one. I think it was one of the events I was running at the time when I did this Calgary Children's Book Fair, which I ran for 2 or 3 years good 10 years ago now, probably. And I'd met the, because I'd often seen those books. I'm sure you had too. You've probably written some of them. I'd seen these books on volcanoes or on elephants or whatever. These kids' books that you saw that all the time. I'd see them all the time when I visited schools, and I'd never really thought, well, who actually writes these? Do they have writers on staff, or what do they do? And then when I met these publishers at these events, it was clear that they contracted people to write these things. And then and it went on from there, and I've written, I don't know how many of those I've written now over the years, probably more than 100, I know that.
Yeah, I've done not that many, but I've done 30 or 40, I think, very similar sorts of things.
Exactly, yeah. Sometimes, I mean, I think in one writing season with one publisher, I think I wrote more than 20, I think, between the fall and the spring. But quite often in the course of the season where they contracted writers, I'd sometimes do a series of five or six. Last year I did a series of five on a book, and they're coming out. I've actually seen them on Facebook or Twitter or something by the publisher. These books are ready. I haven't got my copies yet, but I think they're probably on their way to me. the ones I did last year. So
I actually found getting those copies, it's almost a nuisance because I've got to put all these books somewhere. And
well, I decided yes. I as I sit here at my desk, I actually have them on. Yes, in fact, I do. Most of them are on this bookshelf next to the computer, and not all of them, but some of them are on another bookshelf. Because I thought, well, I've got them all there. Because sometimes if you've only written about 30, sometimes you may forget that which ones you've written and what they were about. You might, because there are quite a lot.
Yeah, and occasionally those things will get rewritten and they still have your name on it, but you didn't do the rewrite. That's happened to me a few times.
Well, sometimes there's been new covers. I know that because my name is on the front cover and they're associated with me, if they're on Amazon or something like that, I know that ones that came out, if they came out 4 or 5 years ago or even longer, they've got a new cover, and I don't have that version. And the text perhaps is the same. Most of the wording is probably the same, but if they have diagrams and charts and graphs in them, they might have all been replaced. I know that sometimes they'll do that. So yeah, it's all keeps us busy
and keeps us writing. And so now let's move on to to the latest series, which is called the Stone of the Seer series.
Yes, it is a bit. It is interesting to say, isn't it?
So the first book is the Stone of the Seer, but Seer, I can't even say it when I'm not putting series on the end of it. So, well, first of all, give a quick synopsis of it, and then we'll use this as an example of your creative process.
Well, the thing is with this is, again, it's as I've said to people in classes and things sometimes about ideas for story, because obviously if you don't have an idea for the story, you're not going to write the thing. And I know that my advice to people has often been, you know, don't always keep the ideas. If you've got a journal where you write ideas down, or you're putting it into a document in a computer or something like that, always keep the ideas, because you never know when you're going to actually be able to work on them. I mean, the one I did, the paranormal series I did in about 2015, 16, and 17, something like that. That was one of the first ideas I had ever had. There was another one about a parallel universe, the Shadow Zone series, another one. It was way back in the list of ideas that I had at the beginning. And even with this one, I was determined to write a story, historical fiction based that was centered on the English Civil War and the trial of the king and all this sort of stuff in the 1640s. And I had some other ideas which seemed to gel with that, but none of it seemed to come together until recently. So sometimes that does happen. And it was actually when the pandemic began, I think I'd seen lots of people on Facebook and elsewhere who were saying to, you know, things like, oh, at least I'll have time now to focus on my novel or my book series. And I thought to myself, do I have anything that's sort of that well developed that I could, you know, think about working on? And I saw this, what I was at the time, I just called it the Civil War series, I think was the working document and everything. And I opened it with trepidation, thinking, well, how developed is this? And when I opened it, luckily for me, the first part of it really that has ended up with being this first book in the series, I was quite pleased to see that I had obviously been editing this as I went along, and it was in good shape, and I had an outline for it and all that sort of thing, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. And so that was in 2020, I guess, when the pandemic was, when we had lockdowns and everything. And so I went to town on this thing, and I got lots of ideas and everything for it, and got it completed, I think, by the fall, and then got some people to read it, and then I did some editing and all this sort of stuff. But it takes a while sometimes to get things organized, especially if you're publishing it yourself and getting the covers sorted out and the design work and all that sort of thing. It's as it says in the blurb, it's set during the turbulent period of the English Civil War, but it also features the Vikings, Leonardo da Vinci as well. So it's like, well, what on earth is that about? Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? I suppose we're trying to get the potential reader to think, what on earth is this about, but in a good way, so that they're interested in learning a bit more about it. I mean, it is a fascinating time period. And as I said earlier on about historical fiction, some things, you know, like the Victorian era and Henry VIII and his six wives, and the medieval period and knights and castles and the Crusades and goodness knows what else, have all been done to death sometimes. And this is a time period, at least, it's not one of those that is as popular, perhaps, for people to read about and things. And sometimes it's one that isn't, that people aren't as familiar with. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write a novel about this. And then it turned into three novels, simply because it was, it just expanded as I was writing it, I guess. So the first one is out now. I just put it out end of January, I guess. It has just come out, and it's on Amazon and elsewhere as an ebook and as a print book. It's all over the place at the moment, and I'm just doing a lot of I've been talking to a few, you know, media people. I'm trying to get reviews and all that good stuff. It's all very new in that sense. The second one I'll be putting out, I think, in the spring, and then I'll probably put the third one out in maybe in the early fall, I think. I don't think I'll put it out in the summer. I think I'll put it out just in the early fall. And then at some point I will have a box set of all three together at a discounted price, I'm sure, later on in the year. I haven't really thought about that yet, not thought that far ahead yet.
And it is a fantastical story as well. I mean, you have magical black stone and mysterious ancient manuscripts and
time. Oh, yes, it's all that. It is obviously set in a different historical period, and it has involved, you know, doing a lot of historical research and things like that. But yes, there are also time travel elements. There's, you know, ancient manuscripts. There's mysterious stones that belong to, you know, enigmatic individuals in the past. There's definitely it did involve research and things, and that's one of the things that came up many times when I was still teaching historical fiction writing classes, I suppose, in person at the universities and things like that. Sometimes I had to remind myself that although historical research was, well, I wouldn't say it was easy for me. It makes it sound, you know, like I'm a genius at this sort of thing, which obviously I'm not. But if you've studied history and things, and you've got a degree in it and things, and you're very interested in it, historical research is probably a little bit easier simply because it's enjoyable. It's not, you don't see it so much as work, perhaps, as somebody who's deciding to, you know, dive into historical fiction for the first time or something. And so it was fascinating to do the research. There's in the second book, which will be out in the spring, that's more, in that there's a lot of stuff that is about the trial of King Charles I and the execution of the king and goodness knows what else. And there are actual, you know, the dialogue and everything at the trial and everything was recorded at the time and everything. So a lot of that has found its way into the book, and it is genuinely what was said at the time because it was written down and recorded. So that does appear in there.
Do you ever fall down a research rabbit hole when you're researching just because you're so interested?
Yes, absolutely, I do, and I've done that. And it's often when it seems to be like side details, perhaps, because you know you realize that you have to get something right about maybe it's the types of saddles that we used on horses, or about weaponry, or about clothing, or about when they're in London, about the streets and things like that, or what sort of things would have been around at the time, what sort of medical knowledge people would have had, that kind of thing. And then, yes, you do fall down rabbit holes. And I know that in the city of London in the 1640s, and for quite a while, there was only one bridge over the Thames, of course, which no longer exists. But there's lots of bridges over the Thames now. But at the time, you've got to be aware of that that kind of thing as well. And even the Tower of London, which has been there since, you know, for an awful long time, it's not always looked exactly the same as it does now, and the access to it was different, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there are research rabbit holes for sure.
Well, you'd mentioned that you had an outline when you went to look. What do your outlines look like? Are they very detailed or just more of a synopsis or?
Well, that was, again, that's something that, again, if we go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, and when you first start doing this, I suppose, either professionally or seriously, one or the other, I just assumed that I had to have the idea and a vague plan of where I would go with the story. And with the first novel, that's probably all I had, really. And I was getting all these different ideas as I was writing the story, and it took an awful long time to do of course, as a result of that. There wasn't really a strict plan. And I started doing the second one in the same way. But then I realized that I should probably have a more detailed sort of outline for that. So that was a bit of a mixture. Once that one was done, I started creating an outline. And it's hard to say. I don't know if there's a strict timeline on when I finish writing the outline and decide, right, that's it, I'm going to make a start. But it's often been about, and bearing in mind these are books for young adults and things, but normally I would say there is probably about a paragraph for each chapter of the book. So on paper, that could be as much as, you know, 10 or 15 pages, perhaps, of you know, one-sided paper if I'm printing it off or something and taking it off to a coffee shop to work on the notes and things like that. If it was an outline that was split into four quarters, perhaps then that third quarter where you're sort of you know there are going to be changes because the story has to end in a certain way, but in that third quarter where all these things are coming together so that the ending will make sense for the reader and all this sort of thing, I guess it's just that there has to be an outline, but I know the outline is going to change throughout the course of the story. It certainly did with the one I worked on last year that is my current project. That started out as not completely different, but certainly it's expanded considerably and will do so again. But no, normally I will have an outline and then at some point I'll decide, right, I'm off now, I'm ready to go with this. And I'll start writing the actual chapters. But the good thing about having an outline, if you're one of those people as well, you don't have to start at the beginning, do you? You can think, okay, I'm in the mood to write chapter 16 today, or whatever it is, and so you can work on that usually.
Well, and that ties into the next thing about process. Although I did want to say that whenever I talk about outlines, I always think of that old axiom that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. No outline survives contact with the actual writing process, at least not in my experience. Maybe in the nonfiction books, but not in any of my...
the nonfiction books, again, sometimes with those, a publisher has provided me with an outline and said, this is how we do these, you know, books about elephants or about nature or about a certain, you know, element of Canadian history or something. And sometimes I've been asked to provide an outline myself. But that's different, again, because if you do, especially certainly if you're doing historical stuff about, say, World War One or Two or something, there's usually going to be a section in there on a two-page spread about the weapons that we used or about the soldiers' equipment, or there'll be a couple of pages on biographies of the commanders of the armies and things, and so that's a little bit different. But no, normally, if I was to, I've never looked at that particularly, but if I looked at the outline of a story, I wouldn't say it survived. No, it wouldn't survive contact with the actual writing in its entirety. But you might look at it and think, this is the basic idea has survived, certainly. Perhaps, once you start writing it, it does change for sure.
Now, what is your day-to-day writing process? You mentioned you don't necessarily write sequentially. I do, even though I have an outline. I always start at the beginning and I push through to the end. But also, how do you write? Do you write at home and do you like to go out when you can? Do you write with a quill pen under a tree in the backyard? How do you write?
A quill pen under the tree? Yeah, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? But no, I think I know that somebody asked me that once about when I was at a coffee shop with writing with a pen and paper, with notepaper and things, with quite a few cups of coffee and things, either on the patio in the nice weather or in the coffee shop. And they were saying, wow, so you write all your stuff in longhand? I said, well, no, not at all. Of course not. I have to, because we spend so much time in front of the computer and things, and especially during the pandemic, we've been forced to stay inside more than before. I do sometimes. I need to go out. I need to get out, and going outside on my own patio or something doesn't, or moving away from the computer doesn't help. And sometimes I'm sitting here getting nothing achieved, and I think, well, I need to go out with my. I have sometimes got the outline printed off. And sometimes it depends if I'm deep into the writing process. You know, I'm halfway through getting the whole thing done or something. I there might be things in my head that I need to get out of my head, and I've got chapter 10 and 11 or something like that. I think, well, okay, I'm going to go to the coffee shop and get those sorted out. And I might do that. I might go out and get out of the house and go to a coffee shop and do that, and then I'll come home and type it up into the computer, and it has helped because I've been away from the computer. But normally, yes, I suppose it's a bit of a mixture. I would write sequentially. I'd start at the beginning, certainly. I mean, I certainly wouldn't sit down, even if I had the outline, and think, okay, I've got the outline, I'm now going to write the final chapter. No, I wouldn't do that. I'd usually start at the beginning. But once I'm into the process, I would occasionally, there would be a chapter that I would be struggling to work on at all, perhaps in front of the computer, and I would need to get away to focus on it, and it helps, you know, to go somewhere else, whether it's usually it's a coffee shop or something locally, when you've been able to do that, of course. Yes.
Are you a fast writer? How long does it take you to write a book, the first draft?
Sometimes it can be remarkably quickly. I mean, there was one that I did last. It wasn't this one. Was this one that's just come out though, about the Civil War? That was last year. That was in the process of being tinkered with and everything like that. But as of about March, I started working on. I started tinkering with my next idea. But as soon as I started doing the tinkering, I started to get quite into it. And I proved to myself that I think it was, yeah, more or less between the middle of March and in about 6 months I completed that really, and I didn't work on it all the time. It was my fiction project, I suppose, for about 6 months, and I was doing other things as well. I was working with other authors. I was doing some nonfiction stuff, but. Yes, if I'm into it, I tend to get it done relatively quickly. I suppose I suppose in a 6 month period, I could certainly. It might not be fit to publish after that time. I still got to be edited and everything else. But yes, I think so. Once I'm into something, I can get it done relatively quickly.
Well, and speaking of the next step, so do you do a. Like, write a whole draft and then go back and start revising? Do you revise as you go? How does that all work for you? And you'd mentioned what are usually called beta readers. It sounds like you use those. So where do you find them and what do they do for you?
Usually it's been friends of mine. Some friends of mine I've used it's usually I suppose like most people. You don't really want people who are going to be telling you that everything you've done is great and that it's wonderful and things, because you need someone to tell you that this doesn't work and be honest with you about a particular story, or this isn't as good as the one you did before or something. Well, I do anyway. And sometimes as well, if it's somebody I know who has read some of the other books, especially the more recent ones, they'll be saying, yeah, you did this in this book, you know, 2 years ago or something. It's exactly the same situation. You think, oh yeah, it is. I plagiarized myself sometimes. So usually it's people I know who will be honest with me and everything like that. So it's important. That's become more important as I've moved more into the self-publishing realm with Amazon and things like that, because obviously I'm doing everything myself except for the things like the cover art and the formatting and the design and things, which I have experts, I suppose you'd call them, who can do that when I'm not as good at that. So yes, it's you need people who are going to be honest. I have edited things as I've gone along. Normally, as I said, with the one that's just come out, I was pleasantly surprised to see that it looked like I had been editing that as I'd gone along and quite in detail. So the first, you know, quarter of it, probably, of this Civil War book had been really edited by me quite severely in the first place before I got to the other stuff. This one that I did last year, I did edit it quite and tinker with it quite a lot, but even when I finished it in the fall, I was determined to put it to one side, and because I thought that I'll put that to one side and do something else and come back to it later. But within 2 weeks, I was starting to have ideas about where it could be expanded, and I was getting new ideas for it and everything. So I will get back to that probably soon, actually. It's my next project, perhaps, is that one, which I will be expanding upon that. Because the version that I finished has got the usual, I suppose, mistakes. It's got some spelling mistakes in it and punctuation errors and goodness knows what else. So it's not perfect by any means. I suppose it would be a first draft, although it's not, you know, it has been looked at by other, somebody else has looked at it and everything, and told me where it may be, where it's good and where it needs work and everything else. So, yeah.
Are there some sort of typical things that you find you need to work on either after through your own editing or if you're working with an editor, do they come back and we all have weaknesses and things that we tend to do by default that then we have to fix later. At least I do. So do you have anything like that?
I'm not sure. I think with the one that I'm working on at the moment, this historical, it's an alternate reality, alternate history, World War II story, which sounds, and it involves magic and folklore and goodness knows what else as well. And, with this particular one, I know that the two main characters are often in they're in the same scenes together a lot of the time, and I don't feel as though I've got into their heads enough and developed them enough as characters and things. But knowing it was a first draft, I wasn't too concerned about that one. I just wanted to get it finished. I wanted to get it finished by October time. So knowing that I was going to go back to it, and I know now that I know now exactly where in the story I'm going to be able to develop these characters and some of the other ones as well. And so yeah, there was certainly I know with that one that where I'm going to be expanding the story and things like that in places. So, but I still have to sort of go to town on that and have a good look at it. But it is the project I would like to work on next, or at least to expand, or at least to improve upon, I guess.
Now you've worked with both traditional publishers, and now you're also publishing yourself, as just about everybody is these days, including me. I did want to ask you because what is the market like for independently published or self-published middle grade and YA fiction? Because so much of that tends to go to school libraries. So is there a market for that? I mean, you've done it, so I presume you're finding people to read.
Well, the thing is, we're doing an interview here at a certain, you know, time in history and things, and things have changed, I think, with self-publishing and things. I think years and years ago, well, not years ago, but certainly maybe 10 or 15 years ago, when people were self-publishing books, they would basically be, they'd be obviously hiring editors and things, presumably, but they would have to have a cover artist, and they'd mostly be dealing with a printer, wouldn't they? In the days before Amazon existed, as well as before Amazon became a very well established, they'd be dealing with a printer and they'd be printing a certain number of books and they'd be hawking their book around from door to door, more or less, and at trade shows and community events and goodness knows what else. And quite often, book covers for self-published books, they looked like they were self-published, didn't they, years ago. But it's tremendously different now, I find anyway. And when I did my last, when the Shadow Zone series came out in 2017, that's 5 years ago now, really. So it is. Things have changed even since then. And I think one of the challenges with it's not even with traditional publishing for young adult books and things. You tend to find that. I found anyway, when I was doing book signings at bookstores, grandparents and parents would often buy.
Yeah.
Books as gifts from me, get it signed, and they'd be buying a picture book maybe for a younger child and things like that. But quite often, yeah, parents and grandparents would be buying these books. Sometimes the child would be with them and they'd be buying the book and saying, well, what do you think to this? Would you like me to this book?
My experience too, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is with adults that, you know, on places like Amazon and other online locations, adults have a credit card and they'll, you know, on file perhaps with them, and they'll buy a book themselves, whereas children don't do that. So it has always been a bit of a challenge to sell books for, you know, kids who are, you know, between 12 and 16 years of age. But since the pandemic has come around, for better or worse, people have been shopping online much more. And whether that has extended to school librarians and things like that, whether they are now buying self-published books on places like Amazon, I don't know. I'm hoping so, because traditional bookstores have struggled for a while, haven't they? Mm-hmm. Really, even the larger chains, and so it's certainly a challenge, and that's one of the reasons I'll probably know more after I've hopefully done the Calgary Comic Expo, and that'll be my first experience of actually standing at a table and enticing people to my table and telling them about my book and hopefully then signing it for them and taking their payment. I'll know a bit more, you know, once we get past that at the end of April, as to whether this is actually still happening. But it's always been a challenge, really, to selling them online. It's the same thing too, often with audiobooks, because sometimes it's not just print and e-books. Sometimes people are producing audiobooks, but I've had some audiobooks of mine. Three or four of them have been audio versions, but how they've done, I don't know, really. It's not something I imagine that young adult readers are doing audiobooks too much. Even ebooks, I'm not sure what the market is like. It seems mostly to be print copies, I think.
Well, based on my daughter, who's now 20, but you know, just coming through all that, there are stacks and stacks of paper books in her room. She doesn't like ebooks at all. She wants the actual print copy, which is interesting.
Exactly, and I know that public libraries will have things like ebooks and things like that. But the school libraries, I don't know what the market is like for ebooks and things. And to be honest, of course, in these strange times in which we're in. I used to do an awful lot of work with schools. I'd be visiting schools all the time. I'd be touring around like a musician, doing gigs and things, going around to schools all over Canada and in the UK. I'd be visiting schools and talking about my books and writing in general and about history and comic books and goodness knows what else. But these days, schools have an awful lot more on their plate these days, just wondering if they're going to stay open, if they're having to go digital with all their classes and everything. And so having, you know, a celebrity guest to come into the school and talk to the kids in the gym and things is probably a bit further down the list than what it used to be. And even, you know, buying books for the library, I found that with a lot of the non-fiction publishers I've worked with, I'm sure that they, of course, have to be able to sell their books into the school library systems too, and I'm sure that's been a challenge as well in recent years.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour here, so it's time to ask you the big philosophical questions.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Not too scary. One of them is, why do you write? The other one is, why do you think anybody writes? Why do we do this crazy thing? And then why stories with a fantastical element specifically? So there you go. Three philosophical questions here to finish off with.
Well, it's as I said at the beginning, why the fantastical? It's really that's because that's what I am I'm interested in, I suppose. I know that there was lots of... it's like I mentioned earlier on when you know Harry Potter was quite a popular thing when I started out, and I was and I'd also read or somebody had recommended to me, I think, the Golden Compass.
Oh yes,
which was because they said, oh, it's just like Harry Potter. Well, it isn't.
No,
and I thoroughly enjoyed. I probably enjoyed that more than the Harry Potter books at the time, and that really had a big influence on what I was doing, because that was more. Yes, there's magical elements to it as well, but there's other dimensions and things like, which was more my sort of thing, I suppose. So I was definitely influenced by the, you know, Harry Potter and the magical thing, but I wanted to write about things that interested me. And so the historical side of it and the comic books and time travel and other dimensions were, I don't want to be writing about something that's, popular, I suppose, and things. I know that one time somebody that I'd heard about this genre years ago, the steampunk genre, and I thought, well, what on earth is that? And I started to find out more about it and everything, and I thought, well, I wonder if I should write something about that. And then somebody said, well, are you interested in that? I said, actually, no, not really. So I thought, well, it's going to be more like work then, isn't it? And I thought, well, yes, I suppose it is. You've got to write about something that interests you. So that's why I do the, I suppose, the fantastical element. And I suppose the first part of your question was, well, why do I write? Well, I suppose it's, that's not something I really considered too much until, I suppose, until probably recently with the, as I've got older, as we all do, and everything. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to be retiring from this unless I have to for health reasons or something. I shall probably continue to do this, and I don't know. I suppose I'll feel compelled to do it. I suppose it's just there are ideas that are going to be. Well, certainly I have that World War II one that's already on the go, and I have another paranormal series that I'm intending to write, and I have an awful lot of. Shorter story ideas and picture book ideas that I intend to get out there, and I'll certainly not be stopping doing this. I don't know. It's just I feel as though I need to write these, and it's not even a case of I need to write them because I want them to sell and people to read them. Sometimes I just feel as though I need to. Get the story completed and done. It's hard to explain. I'm sure it is for you too.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder, but I keep doing it. And there you go. Why do you think human beings have this need to tell stories? And we write them now. At one point, we didn't.
Well, I think they always have, haven't they? I think when people were sitting around the fire, probably they were, after they'd been out, the cavemen had been out hunting all day or something, and they had a tale, something that they needed to tell people, something that had happened to them that day. We still have that, even if people don't end up writing the story down. Sometimes they want to tell, a partner or a friend or something that happened to them that day. It's just that it might not be a earth-shattering story, but it's just something that they feel the need to tell other people about. I think it's hard to explain, really, but we do seem to have that. Not all of us, perhaps, but a lot of us seem to have that that desire. And I think, and as you'd said earlier, there's an awful lot more people. self-publishing now and everything as well. And so it's much easier perhaps to get that story out there now. And so more and more people are doing it. And not all stories are going to be bestsellers, I don't suppose. But we do seem to have that urge to do it. Some of us. More than others, I suppose.
The next question is usually, what are you working on now? But I think you've answered that several times.
That's the thing. At the moment, my plan is to... I do have... The Civil War one is the next... Parts 2 and 3 are done, and the covers are done and all that. I'll be working on the promotion and all that sort of stuff for those for the next 6 months or so. But the plan is to work on the World War II one that I've sort of got a first draft done. Anyway, I will probably be diving into that, I would imagine, soon, I would think, probably before the end of the month. And once I start getting into it, I will be I like to say I have a creative project of choice. It's usually the one I'm working on at the time, because I know, well, I hope that I'll be working on stuff for other people, helping other people with their editing and things, as well as perhaps some non-fiction projects. I'm asked to write articles and things sometimes. I do teaching at the university, so there's always something else on the go. But I have this project, and I'll probably set myself a deadline to try and get... I've proved that I can do a book from more or less start to finish in 6 months, I suppose, 6 or 7 months. So I might, with that World War II one, if that's the one I end up doing, I will probably say, okay, I'm going to say, you know, Labor Day or beginning of October or something, this is where I want to be with this thing. And even if I don't, and if I don't meet the deadline, at least setting a deadline actually helps for me. You know, I'll think, okay, well, if I say, well, I'm hoping to get it done by the end of the year, that's not really going to help. I'll drift off somewhere. But having said all that, I may also end up, I have a very well-developed outline and chapters and things already written for more books in my paranormal mystery series as well. So that may be something I work on as well. So I don't know. And I've also got a picture book project with a publisher, which is close to coming out, and I might be doing more of those. So it's... But at the moment, the World War II one looks like it will be the one, but things could change.
And where can people find you online if they want to keep up with everything you're doing?
Well, I have a website. It's at simon-rose.com. As far as I know, every time if I pump my own name into Google, I must have done a good job with the SEO over the years, because I do crop up right at the beginning there. I am on Facebook, of course, like all of us are, and Twitter and things like that. So I'm on all the usual places. I'm more active on some places than others. I do have a page on Instagram, but I don't do too much on Instagram. But certainly I'm on Facebook and things, and people are welcome to connect with me on there, and places like LinkedIn and things like that. And again, I say I have on the website, there is information about this latest, the latest book series, and the historical background with links to all the history in the Civil War period. That's included in the book as well, in like a glossary at the back. But there's also a web page on that as well. So, yeah, people can find me and connect with me all the time, and I'm in, I'll hopefully be part of, as you will be, with them When Words Collide, but that's not till August as well. And, and I'm hoping that the Comic Expo in Calgary in April, for anyone listening to this who's in Calgary at that time, I'll be there as well, and that'll all be all the arrangements will be sorted out over the next couple of months, I'm sure.
Alrighty, well, thanks so much for being on the World Shaper, Simon. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did too.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, very nice. Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks again to Simon for that great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it. I hope you did too. It's always nice to have a long chat with somebody that you've met casually over the years, but have never really sat down and talked to. And we're both here in Canada, so I'm glad that we had an opportunity to do that just now. That brings us to the end of another World Shapers episode. Just a few reminders. First of all, that the World Shapers podcast is online at theworldshapers.com. That's the main website for it. You can also find it on Twitter at The World Shapers, on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, the two T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. And you can find me on Instagram at Edward Willett Author. And finally on YouTube, where I live stream my walks around Regina every day. Walking in Regina is now up to, must be getting close to 300 episodes, I guess. I live stream it, and then they're also recorded and posted permanently. So check that out at youtube.com/EdwardWillett. And I also put up some writing-related stuff there and might be doing more of that in the future. So please do check that out. Shadowpaw Press, which again has published Shapers of Worlds and Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, anthologies featuring guests of this podcast, is at shadowpawpress.com, just what it sounds like, shadowpawpress.com. It's on Twitter at shadowpawpress, on Facebook at shadowpawpress, and on Instagram at shadowpawpress. And it will probably have a YouTube channel before too much longer. Again, a reminder that Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 Kickstarter is coming up. Watch for that. Should go live, I'm hoping, March 4th, but it might be a week after that, but it will go live in March. And try to raise the funds to make Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 a reality. And yeah, I think that's the main things. Again, Shadowpaw Press, if you are an author with rights-reverted work that you would be interested in perhaps seeing a new edition of in ebook and print-on-demand format, and you're not comfortable doing that yourself, then reach out to me at publisher@shadowpawpress.com, or if you have any other questions about Shadowpaw Press. Okay, there's just one more thing. I forgot to mention it in the opening of the show, but I'll mention it here and play the ad. The World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Direct West. Are you a business owner looking for new avenues to promote your business? Direct West digital billboards are a great opportunity to highlight a new product, a new promotion, or anything else you'd like your customers to know about. You can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com.
And thanks so much to Direct West for sponsoring the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And if you look up the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, you can find many other great Saskatchewan podcasts. Funny that. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. I will be back in 2 weeks after this goes live with Gail Z. Martin is my next guest. And I'm lining up many other exciting guests after that. So the podcast carries on. And again, watch for that Kickstarter in March for Shapers of Worlds Volume 3. Well, that's it for this time. Bye for now.